G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you know, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC podcasts. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to my last interview with Piyush Sahar, who is doing a PhD in computing under the supervision of Dr. Salomer Chowdhury and Dr. Kai Saloma. Welcome to Grad Chat, Piyush.
Yep. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
That's good. Good. So, Piyush, thank you for coming on the show. You started your education in Bangladesh?
Yes.
So what made you come to Canada and Queen's to do your graduate work?
Yeah, so I actually came to Canada to pursue my master's at University of Lethbridge. It's in Alberta.
Yes.
So after completing my undergrad degree, I always had the dream to come to a developed countries for my higher studies. So I decided to come to Canada because the main motivation for me was it's a very peaceful and very motivated country for higher education. So I came to Canada in 2017 for my master's. After completing my master's, I was in a software company, worked there for around 3 years in Toronto.
Okay, during COVID you were doing that then?
During COVID, yes. Yeah. So it was like I started before COVID and then during the COVID I worked from home. Then I decided to come to Queen's for my PhD. It was a tough decision for me, though, because my family members were surprised. Oh, are you leaving the job?
Yes.
Yeah, but I left it because I had the dream to come for my PhD.
Well, that's good, because once people have had the taste of getting a full-time wage every week, it's hard to go back, isn't it? And go,
okay,
I'm not going to get a full-time wage now.
Yeah.
So your family is here with you then?
Yeah, my wife and my son is with me. My son is 3 years old.
Ah, right. So born here?
Yeah, he born in Toronto.
Nice.
So he was 2 months when we came to Kingston.
So, wow.
So he's kind of like birth town is Toronto, but he's Kingstonian right now.
I love it. And so before long, you'll be sending him off to school.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So we are planning to send him to school in this September.
Nice.
So hopefully he'll be in campus in this September. I mean, Queen's campus.
Yes. Oh, that's great. Well, it's nice that you've got your family with you, because I imagine coming from overseas to do something like your studies. Yeah. It's difficult if you couldn't bring your family with you.
Yeah, it's definitely a good support. Like, we feel relieved and we can focus on our study or job, whatever we are doing.
Have you managed to have your extended family come and visit?
Yes. So my mom visited in 2022.
Nice.
And also my mother-in-law and father-in-law, they visited last year.
Have to be on your best behavior.
Yeah, definitely. My mother-in-law actually visited twice.
Oh, nice.
Once in 2022 and again in last year.
To see the baby?
Yeah, to see the baby and the daughter as well.
I'm sure they will be here a lot more often.
Yeah, they were happy. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, there's nothing better than your family being happy where you are.
Yeah.
My mother used to always say, as long as I've been to visit you, I can visualize where you are and everything's then okay. But when she can't visualize, she finds it difficult to make sure that I'm going to be all right.
Yes, because they have some imaginary concepts or thinking on their own, right?
Yes, exactly.
So when they come, they can see, okay, that's what it is.
Yeah. So that's good. Well, I guess we should get on to doing a bit more about your work. Otherwise, we could be chatting here all day.
Sure.
Now, you're in computing, which, as I mentioned before we started this interview, sometimes the word computing scares me a lot because there's so many different areas in computing that people can get into. Some more obvious to people like me and go, oh yeah, I understand robots, sort of, you know, they work. And other parts that are a bit harder, particularly when it comes to incorporating math.
Yeah.
And so I take it you like math and computing as you work with algorithms a lot. So what's the fascination for you with working with math and algorithms and computers?
Sure, yeah. So like from the first day when I started my study in computing, like at the beginning of my undergraduate study, I loved the logic behind it. So right. The logic in computing, it has a very like fascinating relation between mathematics and computing and some parts of physics, and most importantly, some parts of real world activities. Right,
right.
So and we can connect those, the logic and the real world scenarios, then it's really interesting. At least, like, I love it. So that actually drives me to continue my study more and more in computing. So one of my favorite thing when I do my study is to do some outside puzzles, like outside beyond academia,
right?
Some logic puzzles or some real world puzzles which I can connect to my study.
Okay.
And that actually really fascinating for me.
Well, that I'm glad it's fascinating for you, because I remember when I had to do a computing class and they said, Colette, it's just all logic. And I go, but whose logic? Because like, my logic doesn't seem to be working on the same level as you guys are.
Yeah.
But you're right, though. There is logic, of course.
Yeah, one of the major part of in computing is the programming. So we need to do program a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So when you understand the underlying logic behind them, like when you can connect the real world scenarios
with the
puzzles,
yeah,
then you actually love it. Then it's not a burden for you. Then you love it. You love to do it.
And you're looking to see what connects where.
Exactly.
And
then it's not hard for you to not sleep for the whole night and do the program.
I love that. Because it's interesting when we're talking about algorithms and computing and things. I mean, we hear a lot about the word called big data these days. But the questions are usually around, do we have the data we need, or what are we trying to accomplish here? Data, however, can also be manipulated, which it shouldn't be, but it can. But you seem to have found a way that in your work that data can clearly help with improving certain areas of society. Has that always been your intention with the algorithms and things that you use, to use the data to truly benefit areas of society rather than to try and manipulate results to make it look good?
Yeah, you're right. So like the main motivation of all those works, like designing algorithms and coming up with a computing solution, is to make the society better, is to do some betterment for society. But at the same time, when we're talking about big data, like, I mean, in the current era, we have data everywhere, but we need to use it very efficiently, especially for the computing solutions, because the computing solutions, they are artificial, right? We are designing it to perform some specific task. That means the inputs we are feeding it have some specified format.
Right.
So in order to get into that specified format, we need to be able to transform those data into that format, right? So, and we have data everywhere because of the computing applications everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be very careful how we are using the data, how we are collecting the data. When we are collecting, is there any discrepancy or disruptions between like different parts of data, which may cause the solution unfair or are biased for a particular community or group?
Yes.
So we need to be very careful on that. So one of big part of my research is actually focused on that, like how we can come up with the symmetrical data platform for the applications that I'm trying to build.
Yeah, because you actually say your research topic is improving efficiency of societal services for the vulnerable through algorithmic approach.
Yes.
So it's I love this word, improving efficiency.
Yeah.
As opposed to improving manipulation.
Yeah. By the way, data manipulation is not bad every time. Sometimes we may need to manipulate data purposely to come up with a solution which is better for most of the people or majority people. But we, at the same time, we need to be careful how we are manipulating it.
Mm-hmm.
Are we manipulating outside of the regulations, or we are still inside the regulations? So come back to my work, like, yeah, so you're right. Like, I'm focusing on improving the efficiency of some societal services. So when I'm saying improving the efficiency, so in the social services that currently we have in our society, like any governmental operations or non-profit or non-governmental operations, There are multiple communities or people from different backgrounds involved.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to have a solid data or like asymmetrical data for all of the groups in order to make the solution accessible for everyone.
Right.
But what we noticed, like as a background study, that if we include people from different communities or marginalized communities, then we don't have symmetrical data. Their data are really scattered. So we need to come up with a centralized solutions to make their data or make their information to be compatible for the computing applications.
So, sorry, can I stop you there just quickly?
Sure.
So we do have these different societies, different groups.
Yeah.
And you're collecting data and then working with the data. But as you said, you don't always have the same sort of information from each of those groups. So is the first part of what you're doing is finding a common way of collecting the data? So you're comparing apples to apples?
Yeah, so it's not like I'm comparing. So the first part of my work is, it's actually basically like, if I summarize my work, I am developing some algorithmic solution based on transforming our real world people as an agent.
Right.
So I'm developing a multi-agent system, which is a part of artificial intelligence.
Okay.
It's a subtopic of artificial intelligence. So I'm transforming a real people, or like imagining a real people as an agent and making a multi-agent systems. So when I'm developing the multi-agent systems, they involve how I want to make a cooperation among the agents, how right. they are going to cooperate, how they are going to collaborate to perform a task.
Right.
So when I'm talking about cooperating or collaborating, there comes how their preferences are, or how they are going to make their policy of collaborating with the other agents. The first part of data is how the preferences of the agents
okay.
that I'm imagining for a people or for a person, for an individual. So when we are collecting those preferences, as a background study, we noticed they really have different dimensions
right.
of differences. For example, for a homeless and shelter matching problem, we had in a few of my research works. So in that work, we can see like the homeless individuals can come from any part of the country. If we think about Canada, and they have different regions, and their preferences to go into the shelters are different.
Right.
It's sometimes really very diverse. Some homeless individuals can say, I'm not going to leave that city. I just want to live into this city.
Right.
Some homeless individuals may say, I'm okay with any shelters. So their preferences are really diverse. So in order to make that preference as a symmetric platform to be used for the applications that we are trying to build, we need to come up with a centralized systems that can transform different preferences into a centralized one. So we need to come up with a system which can read the data from multiple sources
mm-hmm.
and can come up with a symmetric data.
Okay, so using, this might be unfair, but to using your example, say the homeless, the data you're collecting with their preferences, is that coming from them or from the people who are currently working in those shelters?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So usually for those services, we have a central clearinghouse. We call that clearinghouse. Those can be like any governmental office or any governmental operations or non-profit operations. So they have a platform which collect the data for them and also run the overall applications or overall systems for them, because they might not have access to that applications. So a central clearinghouse does that on behalf of them.
Right.
They actually work on those data. But
they're collecting information for how many people come in, what gender,
yes.
where they've come from,
yes.
that kind of thing. They're not actually asking questions of the individual, or are they?
They do.
So it's a bit of a combination of
yeah.
both.
Okay. It depends on like what the application is.
Right,
like,
it depends.
So when we have that data, then we need to work with making it symmetric for everyone
mm-hmm.
so that we can use it for the application, right? So my first part of work is like coming up with the preference systems which can deal with all those unconventionality or uncertainty on the preferences of the agents.
Right.
So when I'm saying agents, please assume that it's an individual in the society who are involved in the operation or in the service, right? So when we have the agent's preferences, we need to deal with those unconventionality or uncertainty. So my first part of work is how we can build a common or centralized preference system which can deal all those unconventionality and come up with a singular system or symmetric system to make it compatible to use for the application.
And we can use it across the country.
Yeah, exactly.
And so when you come up with this then, because one of your things you mentioned earlier is that, you know, some people want to stay in the same city, others want to move. Are you hoping then that with the system, are you saying that if the person gives approval, they can be moved to a different city to help balance the number of shelters and making sure we're maximizing the shelters?
Yeah, definitely. So there are lots of factors involved. The shelters have some support services, which may be specific for that shelter. And it is possible some homeless individuals only need those support services in order to recover themselves, right?
Right.
So it depends on matching those support services as well and how we can utilize those services. Some shelters may have more capacity than the others. So how we can utilize those capacity as well. We don't want to leave that blank because we have very limited resources, right?
So basically, there's two main goals, isn't there? One, to maximize the services available, and two, ensuring that the individual
get faster recovery,
get the opportunity quicker in an area that they want to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that first part of work, when we have that symmetric preference systems, then my second part of work is actually coming to the core part of computing, which is like transforming the total system as a multi-agent system. And there comes some computational game theoretic approach. So when I'm saying game theoretic approach, it's like in a multi-agent system, when it's a matching problem, for example, the homeless shelter matching, or when it's a coalition-based problem, for example, coalition or team up of some agents for some social work, like disaster response. So in a disaster response system, there might be a team of volunteers who are teamed up for a particular work. So there can be a coalition system, there can be some matching system.
Okay.
So in my PhD research, I'm particularly focused on matching and coalition-based problems of multi-agent systems. So there are like many theories involved, which is particularly from game theory, how the agents are being cooperating or like how their policy is, if based on a situation, how they are going to react. So those are like all those theories we need to study. And then based on the unconventional preference systems, those theories might not match with the preference systems that we just built.
Right, yes.
So that's one of the significant part of my PhD research, to come up with those analysis, how those unconventional preferences have a connection with already built, already analyzed theories.
Mm-hmm.
If they're different, how we can analyze it or how we can simplify that.
So maybe I've missed something here. So with this, I understand what you're trying to do. So is this just all modeling at this point, or have you actually got data that you're using to help you?
So I have not worked with real world data
imaginary right now.
Yes. In my experiment, I actually followed some of the governmental report to prepare my synthetic data. For example, the work on homeless shelter matching, there is a government report on shelter report, which is published every year.
Okay.
So they have a really very insightful patterns, mm-hmm. like robust. How many shelters are there and what are their capacities and those stuff. Those are really useful reports and which we can use for our experiment, which is very close to real world data, but it would be good if we can work with real world data.
So if you figure out what you hope you figure out something, would you test it first on, say, just in Ontario, just in Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox region? Would you want to try it first on a smaller scale?
Yeah, definitely. that would be an ideal approach to try with a particular region or particular focusing area. As you said, like City of Kingston would be a great example.
we all need to sort of help where we can, can't we? And this would actually be, but it's interesting. I mean, I know you've used the example, say, of the homeless shelters, but do you think with the, I mean, this is all math, and a lot of times with math and computing and all those sorts and algorithms, these models can then be used in other scenarios.
Yes.
And it may just be a slight tweak, but basically the model is the same. It's the data that's coming in, or the product coming in is slightly different. Is this what you're hoping that you're, because this would be very helpful for various levels of government.
Yeah. I'm happy that you bring that point, because one of my motivation, or like that's the main motivation actually for my work, is to come up with the framework which can be applicable for different applications in that area. So when I'm saying like societal services, that means it does not bounded to only the homeless shelter matching or those particular applications. It could be anything. And I am particularly emphasizing on humanitarian operations. Like I'm focusing the problems on humanitarian operations. It could be volunteer and food rescue task matching. It could be volunteers and disaster response task matching.
Those stuff.
So my models that I'm trying to develop, or I'm developing these days, it can be applicable for other problems, other similar problems. And that's what my motivation is. Like I can come up with a framework which can be used in different parts of social services in the government level, or maybe in the non-government level as well.
That's awesome. I mean, I imagine a lot of the non-profit places would be really interested in this. I mean, homelessness, food banks, all those sorts of things. You know, where do we need distributions to be working better?
Yeah, so basically I'm trying to show everyone, or show those individuals who are working for, or who are responsible for those operations, that we can model the real world scenario as an artificial intelligence system.
Right.
And that will actually help us to use all those theories or all those algorithmic approach to come up with a new technological solution. So these days we are trying to come up with the technological solutions everywhere. So we are actually co-creating some technology for our society, right? So right now the service is there. I'm coming up with example again, like homeless shelter matching. Right now the service is there. We have some service maybe we have some manual service which is matching the homeless individuals into a shelter. So we are trying to co-creating the technology everywhere. So when we are co-creating the technology in the society, we need to be careful that when you're doing that, we are not depriving any particular communities or any particular individuals.
Right.
So the first question that comes into mind, that are we really accumulating the data or preferences wisely or efficiently, so that no information is missing for anyone?
Right.
So in the first part of modeling, that's what our task is, like coming up with a good preference model, and then connecting that preference model into the existing game theoretic or computational game theoretic theories. If they are really not aligned properly, then come up with a new simplification or new theoretical contributions, which leads into a algorithmic solution. Because once we have that theoretical contributions, then we can develop the algorithm there. And based after we have that algorithm, then we can come up with an applications that everyone can see, like human readable or human usable applications. So the central message that I want to transmit is, see, that's how we can model the real world scenario and come up with a technological solution which is fairer than the existing solutions, because we are accommodating all those unconventionality or all those uncertainty.
So I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here, because I totally get what you're trying to do, and having more preferences in there, understanding the situation is great. The devil's advocate part of me says this solution, the world continues to go on to be crazy, and I'm going to use the homeless shelters as an example, could be one way of one province shifting people out of their province to another province that they don't necessarily want. So here we're saying, you know, someone said, well, I don't mind actually moving as long as, but it could be used in a way that's not ethically
correct.
Correct. Yeah. It could be, well, here's a great way now we can move some of these people out of our province and we don't have to worry about them again.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to them thinking, this is a nice way of us sharing the load across the country, doing the right thing for these people, as opposed to, you know, we've got too many, so let's just shift them because theoretically we can do this. Now, I know that's hopefully not ever going to be the case,
yeah,
but how do you ensure, I guess my question to you then, how do we ensure with these models that we're looking at, particularly if we're looking at how can we distribute services better to more people, how can we ensure that it's not then going to get used for the wrong reason?
Yeah, no, I got the point. So that we can always impose some restrictions on the use of it. Like, for example, when a central body, we can think of government, mm-hmm, is running the operations throughout the country, but each province has some different requirements, or mm-hmm, any city may have some different requirements, we can always put some layers on the using of data in each part of our applications.
Right.
So that will help meeting those requirements of particular city or particular province. And still, they are happy with the applications because their requirements,
right,
are met.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, in order to prevent the wrongdoings or misuse of that, we need to come up with some ethical guidelines,
right,
which we can impose on the logics behind the algorithms.
Right.
So those logics, that's what I said at the beginning, this is really fascinating when we can connect the logics behind the algorithms,
yes,
with the real world scenarios or real world activities. Yeah. Then we can have really fruitful solutions. Yeah.
And that's what I like to hear. Fruitful solutions. None of this backdoor, cloak and dagger stuff.
Yeah.
Let's be upfront with everything that we do and let's all think about our morals and ethics and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Piyash, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's, the word computing will not scare me as much anymore, I don't think.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for explaining what you're doing and your part of helping society using computers and algorithms and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and your time on listening to that.
Okay, well, thank you, Piyash. Yeah. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. And as mentioned, this is also my last time to host Grad Chat. And I just want to say it's been a great experience and a pleasure for me to be on the show from the beginning. So thank you very much to everyone for listening over the years and sticking with me. Moving on, though, my colleague Katie Marie McNeil will be taking over hosting duties. So I know you're all in good hands, and because she's been sitting with me for the last few sessions, just keeping an eye on what I'm doing and making sure she has an idea, although it'll be in her own way, of course, not quite like how I do it. Everyone has to have their own flair. So now, don't forget, though, you can download the show just to finish off things properly tomorrow on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. This is CJ the DJ signing off for the last time with a big hooray.
AMS Food Bank provides confidential and non-judgmental food options to members of the Queen's community in the most comfortable environment possible. The Food Bank helps to ensure that Queen's students can be healthy and productive as they pursue academic achievement and alleviates poverty amongst Queen's community members. We are open Monday to Friday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in room 105 of the Rideau Building. For entry into the Food Bank, we ask to see the sticker on the back of your student card to ensure you are a valid student. We have an amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.
What show do you listen to make your Monday mornings that much better?
Absolutely Frivolous on CFRC 101.9 FM. We play all kinds of comedy, stand-up, sketch, songs, even poetry, and the occasional interview. Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on cfrc.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Today on Wings, Village Goddesses of India.
The divine in India is perceived as the ultimate truth. It is idolized in different forms, such as male and female, and also as semi-human, like that of Ganesha, the elephant god. But each one is treated as an individual power, and people all over the country pray to the divine power of their choice. Against this background, this radio program is about our goddesses and how extremely popular they are in the Hindu mind.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello, I'm Indu Ramesh from Bangalore, India. Today we are talking about goddesses in Hinduism. I have three friends with me, Vatsala Iyengar, broadcaster, translator, and writer. She has four books to her credit about legends, jewels, and sacred objects used in temples. I guess she is just the right person for this show. I also have Gayatri Balu, an attorney who has specialized in corporate law, keenly interested in theater, as well as both classical and folk music. And Aparna Devagiri, a human resources specialist with a multinational company, again deep into classical music and Hindu philosophy. Before we start the program, let me give you a brief introduction about Hindu deities. In India, goddesses are not ordinary women. Hundreds of them are worshipped in the country. Their images are extremely beautiful. 40 different types of diamond, ruby, emerald, and gold jewels, like the crown, the head jewels, dangling earrings, nose rings, bangles, wristlets, finger rings, waist belt, toe rings, and many more adorn them, making them shine very brightly. They are also dressed in dazzling silks and decorated with strings of flowers. Huge temples are built in their names all over India, and devotees visit these temples in large numbers almost every day to seek the grace of the goddess.
Mugi ge natu chanda Joktiya jadi chanda, kollana gulidali chanda, hennina maimyaga, naga yurige chanda, taiya jadi chanda, taiya jadi chanda.
Her nose ring is enchanting. Her long tresses, her symbol of marriage, her armlet adorning the body of a woman are beauteous. The mother's tresses are beauteous.
At the same time, these goddesses are very powerful. They ride a tiger or a lion and kill demons and devils fighting all alone. There are so many legends and tales about their independence and dominance over the male. What do you say, Gayatri?
In India, we have a goddess for agriculture, a goddess for epidemic diseases, a goddess for wealth, a goddess for protection of the city, a goddess for knowledge, and even a mighty goddess to kill evil forces. The list of her powers and her various forms is endless. Vatsala has done a lot of research on this topic. Let's hear what she has got to say.
You are right. Perhaps only in India do we come across such a female-oriented worship system.
What is the reason for the popularity of the goddesses in our male-dominated society?
To answer your question, we have to go back to the very beginning of Indian civilization. As you know, India is basically an agricultural country with over 70% of its population in rural areas. So, naturally, people gave great importance to fertility of the soil and strong sons to cultivate the land.
ಏಳು ತಲೆದ್ದು ಎದ್ದು ಯಾರ್ಯಾರ ನೆನೆಯಲಿ ಎಳ್ಳು ಜೀರಿಗೆ ಬೆಳೆಯೋಳ ಎಳ್ಳು ಜೀರಿಗೆ ಬೆಳೆಯೋಳ ಭೂತಾಯ ಎದ್ದೊಂದು ಗಳಿಗೆ ನೆನೆದಾವು ಎದ್ದೊಂದು ಗಳಿಗೆ ನೆನೆದಾವು
At the break of dawn, the son of the soil prays to the all-important Mother Earth, who fills his field with the aroma of spices. Is there a better way to start his day? In the second stanza, this cultivator makes a votive offering to his family deity to help him grow maize.
ಮೂಡ ಮುತ್ತಯ್ಯ ಮುತ್ತಯ್ಯ ನೋಡ ಬಡತನ ಮೂಡಲ್ಲಿ ರಾಗಿ ಬೆಳೆಯುದ್ದ ಮೂಡಲಲ್ಲಿ ರಾಗಿ ಬೆಳೆಯುತ್ತ ಬೆಳೆದರೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿಸೇವೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿಸೇವೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿಸೇವೆ
To pray for these blessings, village goddesses were created and were worshipped as mother goddess under the common name of Devi, Mata and Amma. The name of the village was also associated with the goddess to establish her power over the area. In fact, even Mumbai got its name because of Mumba Devi, its guardian goddess, and likewise Kolkata from Kali. Let me tell you about an interesting episode. In South India, in the state of Karnataka, by the beginning of the Christian era, food gatherers would place a few neem leaves in their basket with the belief that this would ensure a good collection of food. Neem, as you know, is antibacterial, antifungus vegetation. In a tropical country like India, neem leaves are considered to be helpful in curing diseases like pox, plague, etc. And it is believed that health-granting goddesses can ward off such epidemic diseases. Thus, there are goddesses who carry the name of Plague Amma, Pox Amma, etc. There is even an AIDS Amma for curing this disease. Such is the belief people have in the power of their mother. Think of a goddess as someone beautiful, wearing silks and jewels, etc. But there are many exceptions.
That's true. Not all goddesses are good looking. In Bangalore rural district, a goddess suffers from defective vision. She cannot see anything nearby and has a long sight. So the nearby devotees do not receive any favor from her. On the other hand, people from distant places get her boons.
I will not be surprised if a devotee presents a pair of contact lenses or glasses to the goddess so that she can see even those who are nearby to bless them.
To continue our story, about 200 years ago, plague hit a place called Sirsi in our state, and even the British officer's daughter suffered from this disease. Though a non-believer in Hindu tradition, this officer prayed to the goddess and his daughter was cured. As a further remedy, the wooden image of the goddess was transported from the village and left at the outskirts of another village. This place also did the same, and so did the next village, until the image was finally immersed in the sea. This event is still carried out as a grand festival. In many places, there is no image of the goddess. She can just be a belly stone within the village. At times, she is only a head-shaped stone placed at the outskirts. On this stone, a mustache could be carved or painted to stress her manly powers. Or she could just be a tree. Her body is the village itself, and she has grown roots in its soil.
This concept of a village goddess also has different meanings. For example, just as a child goes to his mother and complains about somebody who has not treated him properly, the villager goes to the temple and complains about somebody who has done him wrong. The mother naturally punishes the wrongdoer, as this story illustrates. Gayatri?
Here is the story. In a particular village of South India, anyone who has been cheated by another person takes a fowl to the shrine of the goddess. He kills the bird, dips his hand in its blood, and thinking of his enemy, smears the wall of the shrine with blood. Once he returns to the village, his enemy suffers from diarrhea, vomiting, fever, and convulsions. Repenting for his sin, the afflicted person offers worship to the goddess and thus ends the enmity. So, the village goddess is the judge to provide justice to the aggrieved person. This method of seeking justice in the presence of the goddess is a very common practice in the villages.
Just goes to show that protection of her people is foremost for her. I think even the concept of fertility of the soil and crops rising out of the earth is still very important to the concept of the village deities.
This is a story my mother used to tell us when we were children and fussed about eating vegetables. Once upon a time, a drought occurred in central India, and sages prayed to a forest goddess by name Banashankari for rains. Unable to bear their suffering, the goddess wept continuously for 9 nights, and her tears filled up lakes and ponds, irrigating the land. She also produced vegetation out of her body and came to be called Shakambari. She is still worshipped in the month of October with 108 varieties of vegetables and fruits.
Fertility, the goddess is also capable of protecting against snake bites, scorpion bites, etc. In one temple, a scorpion appears on a particular day of the year, receives the food given by devotees, and slips away. The goddess is called Rishikeshwari, Vrishchika meaning the scorpion, and this tradition still continues. In many parts of India, a snake pit is also worshipped to pray for children.
Manasa is a North Indian snake goddess, and a tale tells us that when a trader ignored the deity, all his 6 sons were bitten by a poisonous snake. It was only after he realized his mistake and prayed to Manasa did she restore the lives of his sons. In the earlier era, women who gave up their life for the welfare of the community were also worshipped.
There was once severe floods in a village, and a lady by name Channamma protected the entire area by holding both her hands as a barricade against the gushing waters. She lost her arms and died, but was immortalized as a goddess. Her image has no hands, and she is fondly called as the armless Amma.
There are many mythological stories about women who suffered injustice at the hands of males and became goddesses.
Mariamma of South India is an example where a young Brahmin girl is tricked into marriage by a lower caste man. She becomes very angry at this betrayal and kills herself. She punishes her husband by burning him into ashes and transforms herself into a goddess. At these temples, the husband is often shown as a male beast.
I have in fact witnessed a festival in a goddess temple where the male is symbolically humiliated and sent out of the village as punishment. This is really very interesting, as it helps us understand the fierce independence and dominance of a woman over her male consorts in traditional Hindu society in ancient times.
You mean to say that men are often cast in disruptive roles and the village goddess is equated with a civilized and just society?
It's true.
Do you think it is the result of matrilineal societies that existed in ancient India?
Yes. In ancient India, mother right was the basis of social system of the agricultural people. Agriculture was the discovery of the woman. She was the first cultivator of the soil, and her childbearing capability was similar to the vegetative power of the earth. The normal happenings of wind, rain, sunshine, even storms and eclipses could not be explained by the tribal people. They were explained as something from the heavens. The fact that the tree blooms with flowers and then fruits, which is used so happily by the community, must have given rise to the idea of nature as mother. Thus, the initial stages of this economy upheld the supremacy of the woman. The life-producing power of the mother became the central figure of tribal and rural religion. Mother Earth became the womb in which crops were sown. Female figures with a bulging womb and huge sexual organs were carved and were offered magical rites to increase fertility. Thus, primitive mother goddess cult was an important feature of our religion. This identification of earth with woman is universal and can be found in all ancient cultures and civilizations across the world. That is why the cult of the mother goddess has been a very important feature of our religion.
When we speak of the term mother for the goddess of India, we must bear in mind that this word suggests a mother's nurturing aspect rather than act of physical childbearing. Lakshmi is the mother of all, but she bore no children. Nor did Saraswati, the goddess of knowledge. Parvati, the consort of Shiva, is the mother of the elephant god Ganesha and Skanda, the warrior god. But she did not bear them in her womb. This is a very strange fact, as in Indian society, a bride is fully accepted only after she gives birth to a baby.
Another very funny thing is, in spite of being called as mother, the village goddess is a virgin and unmarried. Her untamed sexual energy is magically turned into a very powerful destruction of the demons who are men. Bursting with this energy, she is unrefined, consumes country liquor, and enjoys eating raw meat. So, animal and blood sacrifices are commonly offered to the goddess to please her. Talking about blood, the menstrual flow is believed to make the land fertile, and there is a very fascinating tale behind this. Shakti, the wife of Shiva, one of the major Hindu gods, dies, and unable to bear her death, Shiva roams about like a madman, carrying her dead body over his shoulders. To make him put it down, the other gods cut the body into pieces and make them fall at several places. Her female organ fell at one such place, and the fossilized stone is said to menstruate for 3 days in a year. Thousands of people visit this temple in the northeastern part of India to pray to the goddess on this occasion.
There is a strong relationship between a village goddess and trees. People believe that the goddess lives in these trees and hence do not cut them. Instead, they wrap a sari around the tree, apply turmeric and vermilion, and wave lamps at the tree. There is this story of a village chieftain near Bangalore who cut a banyan tree, not realizing that goddess of good fortune resides in it. He used the wood for household purposes and met a gory death. Trees and plants are also held very sacred in India, and many of them are worshipped as goddesses. Among them, the most popular plant all over India is the basil plant and is called Tulsi. Each traditional house has a small square earthen pot in the backyard where Tulsi is planted, and daily a lamp is lit in her favor.
This tradition has a lot of scientific explanations also.
Tula means one who is incomparable and true to the name. Tulsi leaves have a lot of medicinal value and have proved to be helpful in improving digestion, in curing ailments like gallbladder stones, jaundice, cough, cold, etc. Just one leaf of Tulsi a day can reduce the blood sugar level as well as cholesterol. It can improve the digestive system and can reduce fever.
No wonder today many popular brands of tea contain Tulsi leaves.
Tulsi is considered to be the beloved of Krishna and Vishnu, and a garland of Tulsi leaves is said to be the best floral offering to please the god.
Talking about trees and plants, I would like to tell our listeners about the plant forms of Durga. And foremost among them is banana, a very auspicious plant all over India. Raw banana is used in curries. Ripe ones are eaten as fruits. Its leaves are used as plates on all traditional occasions and marriages, and its bark is used for craft decorations. Turmeric is used as a basic seasoning in every type of Indian cooking. It too has many medicinal properties and is also used as a remedy for minor cuts and bruises. It is the plant form of Durga herself. The wood apple tree is considered to be very sacred, and a single leaf offered with devotion is equal to an elaborate offering. The fruit of the tree is very cooling and is useful in stomach ailments. The goddess of this tree is Shakti, that is, energy personified. Pomegranate fruit is described as the blood-colored teeth of the goddess. Ashoka is a very sacred tree in our country and is believed to increase fertility. A goddess called One Who Is Free From Sorrow lives in this tree. Harvested rice or paddy is a highly auspicious food grain, and no feast or festival is complete without offering it to Lakshmi, called as Dhanya Lakshmi. We worship other traditional plants and trees as goddesses, as they make us feel good.
Trees as goddesses and gods have been well established in India. For example, the neem tree is female and the sacred banyan is male. In our country, villagers often face severe drought, and their way of pleasing the rain god is to celebrate the marriage of the neem and the banyan trees. They plant these saplings and conduct a regular marriage, just as they would do for their children. Slowly, the place around the saplings becomes a meeting place for the villagers, and a small temple comes up there. I have seen one such temple and some 60-year-old neem and banyan trees in a village about 150 miles from Bangalore. I was lucky to find an old lady there, almost blind, who remembered the planting, the marriage, and how the rain god appeared in their village, bringing the much-needed water.
Let me add an amusing story. There is a village goddess by name Kabbalamma. Once she had an argument with her husband as to who is the superior of the two. So they take a bet that whoever goes to the market and buys all the essential things for the house without spending even a cent would win. And the winner has to pour burning coal over the loser's head. So first the husband goes to the market and comes back defeated, as he obviously cannot buy anything without spending money. Now comes the turn of our heroine. She creates a hurricane in the market, and the traders close their eyes to avoid dust. She picks up whatever she wants and comes home triumphantly. On a particular day of the summer months, strong winds blow over the village, and the goddess symbolizes the winds. As part of the event, burning coal is poured over her husband's image. This legend tells us how intelligent and quick-witted a goddess can be.
Just another shoplifter story. It goes to show that being so close to her devotees, the goddess naturally takes on their characteristics, including the very common husband and wife tiffs. Or maybe symbolic gestures are used to tell the story.
Hindu, I would like to say here that just like you or me or any woman, the moods of the goddesses are many. At times, she gets angry and furious and throws a tantrum if not appeased. She loves good clothes and gifts. At the same time, she's so down to earth and practical. She protects people, thus proving herself to be beneficial. She is loved by everybody, and in turn, she loves them, just like a caring mother.
I totally agree with you. Each symbolic gesture and each story about the Indian goddess is full of romance, courage, foresight, kindness, leadership, and so many other good qualities.
No wonder the village goddess has rulers, traders, farmers, and in fact, people from all sections of the society virtually falling at her feet, praising her and adoring her.
Does it mean that in India only village goddesses are worshipped?
No, there are many more sophisticated goddesses. We will talk about them in our next show. To end, thank you, Vatsala, for the painstaking research you have done. Gayatri and Aparna, thank you for your very good inputs. The recording for this show was done by M.R. Ramamurthy, and I am Indu Ramesh, signing off from Bangalore, India, for Wings.
Our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.